Well, it's that time again. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder. I'm the founder of The Morning Pulse and also your host for the Weekly Pulse this week. And we've got a special guest this week who's going to be joining us for the entire show. Very privileged to welcome Miss Angela Moore. Angela comes to us from MarketWatch. Angela, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's been a great week. I was traveling around the country, visiting some folks, but I'm looking forward to sitting down and talking to you and the rest of the great cast we have about what's going on in the wonderful world of retirement, personal finance, technology, whatever. I mean, I know we've got a great show. So how was your week?
My week was great. It finally stopped being 100 degrees every day in New York, so that was a real treat.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I was sweating. I was in Florida for part of the week, very warm. So I managed to escape it in New York, but I was not able, unfortunately, to escape it in Florida. So I sweated a little bit, and, you know, I don't have any hair, so I kind of managed. My hair didn't get frizzy, but I did get sweaty. So you ready for a great show?
I'm so ready.
Okay, well, let's bring in our first segment. She is the technology reporter for The Motley Fool. Let's welcome in Ms. Natalie Walters. Natalie, how are you?
Doing great. Glad to be back. I'm back in New York this week.
How was Charleston?
So I appreciate the weather comments.
Absolutely.
Charleston was amazing.
Yeah, it's great to see family, right?
It's great. And Charleston's such a gorgeous place, and the food is amazing, and the beach is great, the shopping's good. It's a good place.
Well, there's a plug for tourism in Charleston. I'm sure they appreciate that. The Better Business Bureau there certainly appreciates that. So let's I know you've been covering tech. There's a lot going on in technology. We're going to talk to our markets folks later on and what's going on with the FANG stocks. But I think you kind of picked out a few different stories about YouTube and Facebook and content, kind of continuing the themes that we covered over the last couple of weeks. So what's going on?
Yes. So this week there's been a lot of talk about banning accounts linked to Iran's influence campaign that's been running on social media. And Google disclosed this week that it had to ban 39 YouTube accounts that were linked to the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. And also this week, Facebook said that it had to remove 652 accounts linked to Iran and Russia influence campaigns. Wow. So this is, you know, kind of on the lines of what we've been talking about this year, just with Facebook and, you know, how much responsibility does it have and people being upset by, you know, not knowing where their data is going to, or people being upset with, you know, different advertisements that are running next to YouTube videos that aren't ethically all right. You know, it's just this ongoing campaign, ongoing discussion about tech companies. And, you know, they've kind of been in the hot seat this whole year, and that's continuing into this week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, Angela, this is a story we've been covering since, I guess, the inception. And I know it's not really necessarily a finance story, but data privacy, news, that's been in the media, and it has implications certainly for financial services and the information we all consume, either we write about or we consume on a daily basis.
Oh, absolutely. We just are in that ecosystem every single day. And I just think about my data all the time. And then I try not to think about my data because I feel so helpless that all this stuff is out there. And I'm terrified that it's all going to get hacked away.
Yeah, it's scary. There's more data breaches I was seeing published. I think 2018 has eclipsed 2017 already in the number of data breaches. You know, Natalie, this content removal, I wonder if some of this from Facebook is a result of the conversations we had earlier with the Cambridge Analytica, you know, the quote-unquote fake news. You know, this is their reaction to that. And, this is not really a tech question, but when does this all border on, you know, censorship? And I guess they have a right to do that as a private or a public company, but a private entity, not a government. But, you know, I think that there's these ethical lines that I think certainly, and moral lines that certainly come up.
Right, definitely. There's been a lot of talk on that this week, and, you know, there's people on either side of the line with that subject. And I think the main point is that it's a bit crazy that Facebook ever thought it could sort of control what goes on its Facebook platform when it has over 2 billion users. You know, there's really no way to regulate that and to regulate that high amount of content. And it's obviously trying to do a better job of that now after the big Cambridge Analytical scandal earlier this year. But I don't know if you can think of a solution for that, but I don't know that I can think of a way to monitor 2 billion people and, you know, where the posts are coming from, what organizations they're coming from. You know, there's so many ways to create fake accounts, and, you know, that's a huge problem for them. And you know, it's a bit, it is also, you have to think about the fact that the 2 billion users don't seem to especially care about this. You know, Facebook hasn't been negatively affected too much by this. So that's its main motivation for fixing things. You know, it's, if it would be losing, you know, millions of accounts a day, but that's also not something that's happening.
Yeah, I think obviously this is a continuing story. I guess we'll cover it week to week now. It looks like this is going to be a topic du jour. Shifting gears a little bit, or a lot maybe, Alibaba is in the news as well.
Yes, Alibaba reported its quarterly earnings this week, which is a big deal because it's, you know, a huge company in China. It's the biggest e-commerce company over there. And it reported its strongest rise in sales ever, over 60% year over year. And however, it was a bit of a mixed quarterly report because its profits are being weighed down by heavy investments, and it warned investors that it expects for pressure to continue to be on its profits because of these heavy investments. And what those investments are is actually brick and mortar investments, because Alibaba has always been known as an e-commerce company. But what it realized is that by only going for online sales, it's missing out on a huge percentage of retail sales by not having brick and mortar stores. So it's been investing in brick and mortar stores by updating them, by putting technology in stores. And that way it can get both online sales and brick and mortar sales. And that's going to help it in the long run. And some examples of that is it's teamed up with Starbucks this month, and it's going to start delivering Starbucks to people in China. It's recently bought a food delivery company. It operates a car vending machine where you can actually go up to the vending machine, test out a car, and then actually purchase that car through the car vending machine using your Alibaba app. So it's got a lot of cool brick and mortar partnerships going on right now, but that's weighing on its profits.
Well, not only that, car thing is crazy. You know, it sort of reminds me of what Amazon does with investors. You know, they put out their quarterly results. Sometimes they disappoint the street, but there always seems to be a larger focus on what they're trying to do down the road. Is that similar to what Alibaba does?
Definitely. That's definitely how I see it. And this brick and mortar strategy, they have called it their new retail strategy. And that's something they've been really pushing for. And they said earlier this year, they're already starting to see positive results from that. You know, some of its older new retail projects, like its supermarkets, it started, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, they're already starting to add to Alibaba's revenue each quarter. So wow. It's hoping that'll continue, right? And so in the next, you know, 5-10 years, that's going to be a big contributor.
Well, great. Well, Natalie, can't thank you enough for joining us on the show this week. And we'll check back with you, of course, next week. And enjoy your weekend. And hopefully it's not too warm.
Thanks so much. Always good talking to y'all.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, welcome back. We've got another great segment. And now I am joined by two Angelos. So we have Angela Moore, and just to clarify, she is the retirement editor for MarketWatch. And now we're also joined by Angela Antonelli, who's been a previous guest, and she is the executive director for the Georgetown University Center for Retirement Initiative. So, Angela Antonelli, welcome to the show, or welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me, and I appreciate it, and it's great to be able to speak with Angela as well.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much. So it's been quite a few weeks, maybe actually several months since we last spoke on the show, but the Center for Retirement Initiatives continues its efforts, its work in helping to facilitate discussion around retirement income, retirement coverage in the United States. So if we wanted to check in with you in terms of research and things that initiatives that are going on, can you share what you've been working on?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, Jeff and Angela, I can't thank you enough for participating in the Center's June Policy Innovation Forum. You were a part of a terrific panel talking about retirement savings challenges. So, you know, again, it was a great discussion. But, you know, when we decided to host that forum, we call that forum Driving Change to Improve Long-Term Outcomes. And that really sort of captures in a nutshell the direction and focus of the work here at the center on retirement issues, and really what we're focused on is there's a lot of discussion about strengthening retirement security, but I think we really need to talk more about what that means and do a bit of a deeper dive around what that means, parse out pieces of it, and I think to date there's been a lot of great discussion. And initiatives, and as you all know, the Center for Retirement Initiatives has spent time focusing on models for state-sponsored retirement savings plans to expand access to private sector workers, and I'll come back to that in a bit. But in addition to what we're trying to do to expand access to ways to save, you know, helping people have access to ways to save and then to be able to begin to save is certainly important. But it isn't sufficient. When we talk about retirement security, there are really other important elements to that. It's a continuum. So it's getting people more access. It's then using tools and information and ways to help them engage and actually begin to save when they do have that access. But there are also the other important pieces. They have to then invest that money and make decisions about how to do that. So we need to look at the investment component. And are there ways that in a defined contribution world and the investment choices that people have, are we really doing what we need to do to maximize investment performance? People really having the access to asset class and diversification in their investments that allow them to maximize the returns on their dollars invested? And then ultimately, at the end of the day, it all what matters most is lifetime income. The ability to develop a stream of income that's going to last a lifetime once you do retire, and to come up with mechanisms that help individuals make the best and the smartest decisions. There's no one size fits all, but certainly provide them with information and tools and options when they're ready to retire so that they don't necessarily feel like the best option is to take a lump sum and then go try to figure it out. Which is difficult to do, but to give them some options to be able to do that. So in the big picture for the center, the areas that we're focused on is access and the state initiative. With respect to the state initiatives, what we're excited about now is the fact that there are 10 states, there's one city that are enacting programs. Four of the programs are already accepting and enrolling workers. Oregon is already over 6 million in assets under management, more than 30,000 workers who weren't saving before, saving today. Illinois pilots off the ground, California's will be soon. And so that's all, those are very exciting developments. Other states will come online soon. So the state initiatives, great progress, but the states have been doing it sort of individually. And one of the pieces we released at our forum in June introduced the concept of multi-state collaboration. And really, quite simply, what that means is by working together, states can help to do even more to expand access and allow more workers to save to retirement. And really what we talked about, and I wrote in an opinion piece recently for MarketWatch and for Angela, was, you know, one of the ways that we continue on this journey to help make sure that people are not retiring into poverty is to expand access. But by getting states to start to work together, and, you know, we look to the examples in this working paper that we issued of College 529 savings plans as well as the more recent ABLE program, which allows families to save for a disabled child or an adult to help them be more financially independent. And if you look at 529's and ABLE program, states are working together. You have models where, in the case of 529, around for a long time, you know, residents in one state can save in another state's program. In the case of ABLE programs, we've really seen more interesting collaboration with, you know, states making decisions to simply use the program of another state. They can brand it for their own state. It could be, you know, the Wyoming ABLE program, but Wyoming has in turn chosen to use all of the program administration, investment, and operational mechanisms of the Ohio ABLE program. So we wanted to put those ideas forward and encourage multi-state collaboration and for folks to look to 529s and what we've seen with ABLE programs, to also look at it in the retirement space. And to the extent that we already have 10 states in the city and there are other states interested, they can know that they don't necessarily have to do it on their own. They certainly can look to collaborating with others.
Yeah, I mean,
so
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think it just from a logical point of view, that makes sense. In the retirement business, any business, it's about scale, and why not leverage resources across multiple entities? In this case, states, cities, municipalities, all those kind of things. Bring it together, and also there's lessons to be learned, as you stated, from that, you know, from the Oregons, the Illinois, the Vermonts, that can be encompassed into the consortium.
This is so great, Angela. I have to say, I love listening to you speak, and it fills me with great hope because I spend so much of my day feeling very discouraged about what's happening with retirement and Social Security and the fact that so few people have access to workplace retirement plans and all of that. And when I hear you speak and you and all the smart people at Georgetown are just doing such great stuff. And, you know, one thing that makes me, well, I don't know, concerned or pause is once people get access and once they are engaged, you know, and they start up their account and they get to that investment piece, do they need help to take that step? Are people, I don't know, I find it overwhelming to pick retirement investments and, you know, this is what I do. So how do you get people to do that investment piece?
Well, you know, on the investment side, I think what we've learned from research studies, certainly, and sort of an initial direction here is just to keep it, right? So for a lot of employer-sponsored plans, we also see it as the states have developed their plans and their investment options, is to keep it simple, keep the choice. You know, I've certainly had employers that, you know, you sign up for the retirement plan and here's the 140 different possible ways you can invest your money. Oh, that's
exactly.
Really easy to do. But the literature tells us that, you know, significantly narrow that. And we've seen that start to happen. I mean, in the state programs, for example, they're generally offering, you know, maybe three or four choices. We certainly see with employer-sponsored plans also narrowing those choices down. Then we also see in the context of the investments, the target date funds. And, you know, target date funds, you know, sort of plug and play almost, right? There's mm-hmm. a glide path. So if you're someone who's going to retire in 2030, you know, and you know that hopefully 30 years earlier, you have a 20, or move it out, say 25 or 20 something now. So you're going to retire in 40 years. So what's 30 years from now, you know, 2048, you pick that 2050 target date fund. And, you know, the glide path will basically adjust in terms of the asset mix. So that obviously, as you're getting closer to retirement, you're going to be in less risk.
Right.
And the shift more out of these bonds and that kind of thing. But one of the things we've talked about is with, you know, target date funds becoming, you know, ubiquitous in the investment suite and the fact that more than, I think, 90% of plans today offer suites of target date funds is, okay, well, let's look at target date funds. Is there a 2.0? Are there ways that we can improve the investment performance of target date funds? And that, I appreciate you raising this question because it points another piece of research that we released in June around the performance target date funds. And, mm-hmm. you know, the one thing that we know that works well is the greater the diversification. Again, you're working to mitigate risk. time, generally improve performance. So what we did in conjunction with Willis Tower Watson was a study to look at and say, okay, if we were to take target date funds and if we were to diversify the asset class at three specific asset classes, you know, would we see improvement in performance? And the answer was yes. So over time, generally, you'd see somewhere in the order of 11 to 17% increase in retirement income. And what the good thing about the diversification does is not only improve the investment performance as you're leading up to retirement, but if you do in fact hold on to those target date funds in retirement, it also helps to extend because of the improved performance, that alpha, additional alpha that you get from the diversification, that you actually are able to have income last a longer period of time. So again, I think employers are definitely doing things to help workers, simplifying the choices. You know, what we see with the increased use of target date funds, the debate, I think the discussion now we're trying to facilitate is the diversification and can we strengthen that investment performance. But then again, you know, other tools that our employers are using to really help workers make decisions. So I think they're also focused on what additional information and data do they now have and greater access to, which our tech panel talked a little bit about that. With the use of big data, employers now have more and better information. The challenge is taking all of this data now and trying to figure out, okay, how can we take information that allows us to understand individuals a little bit better and how their needs are different, but to actually translate that into changes in behavior and engagement and the decisions they make with respect to retirement. So there's a lot we know, and things are moving, and I think plan sponsors and providers are working really hard to do a much better job, but there's still a long way to go.
Absolutely, and we certainly appreciate you coming on and sharing that, but we certainly agree. You got to keep your feet moving and keep heading towards that goal, and you know, it's a baby step sometimes, unfortunately. Angela Antonelli. I get confused. I'm bookended by Angela.
So many Angelas.
Angela Antonelli from Georgetown University Center for Retirement Initiatives. Thank you so much for joining us and have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.
Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it. Take care.
Bye. Welcome back, and we've got another great segment. This time we're going to be talking markets, and again, I'm joined by Angela Moore. She is the retirement editor for MarketWatch. We're joined now by George Grombacher, an advisor based in Scottsdale, Arizona, and of course, joining us from the set of the TD Ameritrade Network, lead anchor, Mr. Oliver Rennick from Chicago. Oliver, how are you, bud? George?
Hey, everyone. Doing well. Just ready for the weekend.
Absolutely. We're all ready for the weekend, but we can't stop. We've got to sum up the week in the markets. George, let's start with you. You're also the host of a podcast, called The Money Savage, but you're also an advisor. What's top of mind for you as you've been covering, canvassing the United States, working with plan sponsors?
Well, I've been asked numerous times over the past week about the passing of Aretha Franklin, how, unfortunately, like Prince, who died in the last couple of years, she died without any estate planning. So no will, no trust, nothing like that. And so I think that whenever there's an event like that, a very sad and tragic event like that, people are curious, well, maybe this is something that I should have, or maybe this is something I should look into or think about. And like so many different things that we ought to be doing, if we're not compelled to do it, if we're not compelled to save, if we're not compelled to buy insurance, if we're not compelled to do estate planning, then people oftentimes don't. So as to whether or not you should have it, well, there's a lot of great information that's out there. We actually did a podcast last week with Liza Hanks about who should do it and when they should think about it. So you can check that out, or you should talk to a professional, an attorney, about whether it's right for your situation. But long story short, I think that the grown-up truth for this week is short deadlines and high expectations. So it maybe doesn't feel good to do it, but give yourself a deadline for getting these things done and just do it. And I know that short deadlines and high expectations are also something going on with earnings right now. So I'll kick that over to Oliver.
You know, this has been another week where you kind of get confirmation of why so often you have investors, traders, pundits, commentators, whatever, myself included, kind of talk about the importance of fundamentals. Now, that often leads to sort of like an outcry of critics saying, you know, these guys on TV always just talk about fundamentals when they don't know what else to say. But this week, week is actually a pretty big reminder that it really does matter. I mean, if you're puzzling and scratching your head over why stock markets are back at all-time highs, despite, you know, headlines about what's happening with the White House and politics and tariffs and you name it, essentially there is just a massive surprise that I think is going pretty underappreciated, and that is the second quarter of stock earnings. This week was a very specific subcategory within that of retail. Tons of retail names, tons of apparel names especially. You've got traffic at all-time highs through the doors of Target. You've got companies that are able to demand higher price points for their items. You've got Free People at Urban Outfitters charging like $80 for shirts and people are buying them. So there is a very distinct message being sent this week, especially about the power of the consumer. All this is happening on the back of big economic data in the form of retail sales, red book numbers. That was definitely the story of the week in terms of a vote of confidence in the economy. Now, the caveat, as there always is, we like to just try and embrace moderation in our coverage. And the flip side is that there are a few points in the market that and the economy that aren't perfect. Housing is one of them. So you could pair these two things together and say, well, housing's weak, so the economy is not great, but you know, consumer activity is fantastic. So what are we supposed to take away from that? Well, maybe consumers have enough money to go out and run up a credit card bill for $1,000. They just don't have enough credit built up to, you know, buy a house. So there continues to sort of be, you know, some chinks in the armor of a very strong U.S. backdrop. But this week is just another slew of data that is really hard to argue with that demonstrates the power of the consumer. That's my biggest story this week.
Well, great, Oliver. Thank you. So Monday you were back at the NASDAQ filming your show in New York City. One of the things you talked about a lot of good things I was watching. Of course. I'm one of many, I'm sure. But tax reform, what's the perspective? I know you did an interview. What's the perspective from the investor on tax reform?
Happening? That's a good question. It's pretty interesting because we talked with Grover Norquist, who, if you don't know, he is a very passionate, advocate for tax reform. Americans for Tax Reform is the organization. Obviously, has been a huge proponent of what's happened already in taxes. But the reason why we talked to him is because he basically leads a community that is trying to push for even more tax reform. And this is coming this is coming during a week where there are, you know, more questions about the political climate and what it means for markets, because if you could easily make the case that, you know, since November the president has been in favor of the markets, that's become a little bit more difficult with tariffs, because investors don't like that outlook and they worried about the potential risk of that. A lot of economists have come out against that, but overall you've had tax reform, you've had deregulation of things that Wall Street has viewed as positive. But if there then is a sea change in the political environment in D.C., what does that mean for markets? It's a very fair question. This, of course, is also happening as the president says the market's going to crash if he gets impeached. So I'm not into speculating on the politics of what might and might not happen, but from the market's perspective, it becomes pretty important to try and figure out sort of what the catalysts are behind, you know, what's happening in the market, what's happening in the economy. A lot of it has already been in the works for a very long time, and then you've kind of had the cherry on top in the past 18 months of what's happened with things like taxes and deregulation. So the big question out there is how long the current tax effects will show up in the market. There's a lot of debate to that. This earnings season was, again, this past quarter, which surprised so many. 84% of companies beating expectations suggested that maybe there could be a good bit of, you know, fuel to this fire. But I think a lot of people are going to, again, continue to focus on that, you know, maybe after these midterm elections to see what happens. But there is still the potential for sure for, you know, policy-driven action markets, I think, no doubt.
Oliver, certainly, and George, thank you so much for joining us this week. Oliver, I know you're due back on set, but we appreciate you joining us. And George, I know you're busy with clients. So, guys, thank you, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, that was another great segment, and welcome back. We're going to be talking about fixed income. And we're joined by the Senior Portfolio Manager and Co-CIO at Octagon Credit Investors, Mr. Michael Nechampkin. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's very good to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
I know. I know you're quite busy, so we appreciate you taking time out of your day. You know, we talk on this show and really educate people about the markets, educate about personal finance, but we don't often dive into specific topics. And I want to use this time to do that. And I think, you know, your organization has a large portion of its assets under management in bank loans. And I think, you know, this is a specific area of fixed income. And I'm wondering, could you just break it down real simply for the audience? What is a bank loan?
Sure, Jeff. You know, when we talk about investing in the bank loan market, we really mean large floating rate, below investment grade, so mostly double B and single B rated, senior secured term loans issued by some of America's largest banks and distributed among hundreds of institutional investors and smaller banks. Today, the loan market is about a $1.3 trillion market, mostly institutional market. And it's a market which developed over the last 30 years as the large banks found that they could make more money and get better regulatory treatment by originating and then syndicating these loans off the balance sheet. So, for example, when J.P. Morgan a couple of years ago lent $5 billion to Sprint Corp or Credit Suisse a few years ago, lent to Dell Computer as part of the LBO a few years ago, it was inefficient for the banks to keep a huge loan of that size on their balance sheet. So in the Sprint case, J.P. Morgan kept a $2 billion revolver line just for the agent banks. And then they went out and they syndicated the term loan that they made to mutual funds, pension funds, life insurance companies, foreign banks, CLOs, and a large number of other institutions who were glad to receive a double B loan paying LIBOR plus 250 or 4.5% in today's market. And again, usually the agent banks keep the revolver facility and often a term loan A as well on their own balance sheets.
Great. Well, thank you for that.
Going back, what?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I was just going to talk a little bit more how the market had developed over the years. It's really become a very liquid market because there's so many investors in the market today. And as opposed to direct lending or the middle market space, it's a $1.3 trillion market where billions of dollars trade on the average day. So investors have the ability to actually get in or get out as they prefer at different times. And I just wanted to also mention the two most differentiated features of senior secured loans in the broadly syndicated loan market are the floating rate aspect and the collateral. And floating rate is they reset at least quarterly. Most of them reset monthly today based on LIBOR changes. So they're very low interest rate duration, which is unique for a credit product. And in periods of rising rates, loans have generally outperformed traditional fixed income because of that.
Okay.
On the collateral side, they're secured by collateral, which provides protection in case of bankruptcy. And floating rate senior loans are generally viewed as defensive in the capital structure because they occupy the senior most part of a company's capital structure. And they're secured by really all the value of the company, so equipment, patents, plants, trademarks, customer lists, subsidiaries. And that puts loan senior recovery to most other creditors, ahead of bondholders, shareholders, or even suppliers and workers in most cases. And as a result, even when a borrower does go bankrupt, over time, the data shows that borrowers typically get 60 to 80% of their money back on average throughout the cycle. And as a result of those two factors, you've actually had a lot of less volatility than other asset classes. I think the Sharpe ratio for the last 5 years is somewhere around 1.5 for bank loans, which translates to attractive returns for low risk.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that, Michael. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's often hard to conduct an interview when you're not seeing the person. So when you look at this, I'm sure you can sympathize. We all do these conference calls from time to time. So when you look at the below investment grade credit market, let's have the glass half full and the glass half empty. What makes you optimistic, and then what makes you concerned?
Sure. You know, the current economic environment, which is really characterized by strong corporate profit growth. We just saw terrific numbers, especially for stocks. I think the S&P 500 showed average profits growth, earnings growth of about 25%, and expectations for the third quarter are quite healthy too. So we have strong corporate profit growth and rising interest rates, and make for an interesting time for bank loans. These are times when typically bank loans have done well. Because these are below investment grade loans, defaults can be high in a recession. So it's important to us to see a strong earnings and GDP growth backdrop to keep defaults low, and defaults today are well below long-term averages. According to Moody's, they actually expect defaults to drop by about a third over the next year. The Fed continues to be committed to raising rates, we believe, and that should result in LIBOR increases. So that should mean higher yields for loans as well, as typically as the Fed raises Fed fund targets, that results in higher LIBOR, and higher LIBOR results in higher yields, even on our existing portfolio, again, as each loan resets monthly. Historically, bank loans have actually outperformed traditional fixed income in periods of rising interest rates. And in February of this year, when stocks were swinging 500 points, and bonds had one of the worst months ever, loans actually did well and eked out a positive return. But we're credit guys at Octagon, and credit guys typically see the glass as half full, if not maybe a third full. And there are things out there that are worries. The biggest concern should always be a potential spike in defaults. We don't see that imminently, but it's always the risk out there. And typically that means a recession, but it can also be a sector-specific problem like we had with energy in 2015 or even in 2016 with retail. From a more technical perspective, if the market starts to think that rate hikes are done, money may start to flow out of the leveraged loan market, and that could put some technical pressure on loan prices. We've seen that in the past. And, as lenders, we also have a concern about weakening covenants and other traditional lender protections that we've seen in underwriting. And, we're also seeing this in the high yield and investment grade markets. It's kind of a hallmark of being at the mature phase of a credit cycle. And while it's not an imminent danger, it could lead to lower recoveries and more price volatility in the next default cycle.
So I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question. I know you're not on a game show, but and we certainly don't want to be talking about gambling or anything like that. So, all joking aside, where are we in the credit cycle? What's your view?
Sure. I'm actually going to escalate that quote, the $1.3 trillion question for us in the leveraged loan market.
Sure.
Because that's what drives the whole market. There will be another downturn. This is one of the largest U.S. expansions on record. The economy is actually picking up speed now again, even though it is in a mature state of the cycle, and that's unusual. But it won't go on forever. And, while we're long into the cycle, I wouldn't call it a traditional late cycle, so maybe long cycle rather than long in the cycle rather than late cycle. The good news is we don't see a major credit downturn in near sight. But when we talk to many borrowers and we review economic data and look at what the economy is doing real time, it generally supports our view that defaults should stay below average for a while. A recent survey showed that most economists don't project a recession until 2020 or beyond, actually, for a number of them. And again, as I mentioned, Moody's just came out with some new data, their new projection, and they see the speculative grade default rate dropping from 3.3 to 2.2% over the next year. And what really feeds that is their economic data, as well as various signs of credit stress in our market, and leading signs of credit stress in the market, which are all at fairly low levels today. Some of them at record low levels.
We've got about a minute left in the segment, and one of the things, just want to get your take on this, one of the things that we hear about in the news consistently is the talk of tariffs, either the U.S. laying tariffs on imports or vice versa with other companies. Want to get your perspective on that, because that has some implications with lending and certainly U.S. companies that maybe, without naming specifics, that you might be looking at. So want to see if you could give your perspective on that.
Sure. Tariffs is one of the biggest questions that we focus on with our borrowers and that we get from our investors. So far, we really don't have a lot of tangible data to report from what we're hearing from our companies. We've seen a couple of companies report benefits, especially some who are direct beneficiaries, like in the steel space. And among many industrials, we've been surprised how many of them have actually increased margins. When we talk to management teams today, their bigger concern seems to be logistic challenges and finding qualified employees. But I think there will be some unexpected tariff impacts, especially due to supply chain issues. Supply chains have become so complex globally over the last few years that even though a company may be able to say, yeah, we don't have it at that first tier, but for them to see what happens one, two, three tiers down when you're going to Asia, to Taiwan, to China, to Europe, and as their supplies and parts go through and have value added, it can be hard to tell. So I think we're going to see some unexpected areas, some surprising results, some earnings misses as a result of that. One of the things about being in the loan market, though, is it's a little bit more forgiving. So a small earnings miss in the equity world can have a big impact on stock prices, but loan returns are generally less volatile because we're really focused on the borrower's ability to pay interest and fixed charges. So if a company misses by a few cents per share or a few million dollars, it often doesn't have the same kind of impact it would have on the stock valuation.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for that. And we appreciate you giving us a look into the below investment grade market, especially bank loans, and hopefully you can come back and we can talk about the various market cycles throughout the year and into next year.
That would be great, Jeff. We really appreciated the opportunity to talk a little bit.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, and enjoy the rest of your summer, even though it's only a week away from ending.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Welcome back, and now we're going to be talking personal finance. And again, I'm joined by Angela Moore. She is the retirement editor for MarketWatch. And we're joined, of course, by Ali Melito and Jacob Passy from MarketWatch. So it's a little bit of a family reunion here. Everybody, let's sing kumbaya. Welcome to the welcome to the show, Ali and Jacob. And Angela, it's nice, I'm sure, to be reunited because it feels so good.
Right, my dear friends.
Ali, we'll start with you. Unfortunately, we had the passing of a legend, Aretha Franklin, just an amazing singer, beautiful voice, passed away this week. And I know you wrote a story about this and covered it. So what's the angle that you covered?
So Aretha Franklin, who, you're right, had a beautiful soul, unfortunately did not have an advisor, or at least didn't listen to an advisor when it came to creating a will or a trust, which is kind of problematic considering she had four sons and about $80 million in assets. At least that was an estimate that people had come up with. The problem, of course, as you know, with not having a will means that it's been up to the courts to decide how that money is allocated. Or divided, rather, and that means, well, because she was in Michigan, it was divided equally among her sons. But if she had any specific wishes, maybe she wanted somebody to have more than the other, that was not communicated in any sort of documents. And it also means that her estate files are going to be made public during the process, which, you know, I personally think if you can avoid it, you should. So,
Ali, what if you're not Aretha Franklin? What if you don't have $80 million? Do you think that having a will is important just for everyday people, or is it just for the rich and famous?
No, I think I personally think everybody should have a will, but especially if you have a spouse, or if you have kids, or if you have a home, or you have basically anything that you care about and you want. You have a specific desire to go to a specific place, because if you say you have a house, the courts will decide based on the state that you live in who gets that house? And what if you don't want, you know, your son to have it? Maybe you want your niece to have it because your niece was always with you. You have to actually communicate that, because it's not going to happen. Your wishes will not happen just because you thought of them. So anybody, even if you have just a house, which I still think is a decent amount of property, a decent asset. It's not $80 million, but it's still a pretty fair asset to consider.
No, it absolutely is. I think that people fear the expense and fear, I don't know, when my husband and I did our will, we put it off for a very long time, but getting it done felt amazing, even though we had to confront a lot of deep thoughts about our eventual demise. I felt happier knowing that at least that was one thing about my death that I could control.
Yeah.
I think that's the main problem. Just that people, they don't want to think about it. I mean, it's not a pleasant thought, you know, thinking about your demise, but also I think they're just misunderstandings about how much it could cost to create a will or how much you need to create a will. And if people think that they don't have enough, like even if they do have a house or some savings away, if they don't think that's enough, they're not gonna do it.
Chiming in just to add that not only should you have a will, but you should keep it updated.
Yes.
If you have any, major life changes, if you have a new kid, if you, remarry, what have you, it's important to make sure that squared away, because like Aretha Franklin has four kids. If she had made a will, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, what have you, her family situation would have been much different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's a great point.
That is absolutely a great point. I mean, many of the things that we're talking about on this show and in finance, you don't just get to do it and then tuck it away. You've got to revisit it over the span of time because your life changes, as you said, Jacob. So, thank you, Allie, for that. And Jacob, you always have such great stories. You had chicken one week, and the chicken was like the meat that I think was most common to go bad, if I recall the story. But this week, I think you're talking home value. So you have a little bit more, normal story, but a traditional story. So what say you on the topic of home values?
Yeah. So in some markets, we're starting to see home value growth slow down. So Zillow had a report that came out that looked at basically, they have monthly reports where they analyze home values, not just for properties that are listed for sale, but also just for any old property. And they found in some of the, hottest real estate markets that we've been talking about for a long time, the rate at which home values was going up had slowed quite a bit. So one market in particular was Seattle last year. It was seeing the fastest rate of growth in home prices across the country. And this year it's only 12th highest. And so that this is just, kind of another indication that the tides might be turning a little bit in the housing market. There are growing concerns that because of how expensive it's getting to be in many parts of the country to buy a home, that more and more buyers may be just deciding to wait on the sidelines in case prices go down or just because they can't afford it either way. This is starting to finally have some ripple effects. So it's not a buyer's market yet. I mean, it's certainly, in the markets that Zillow was looking at, like Seattle, it's still extremely expensive to buy a home. And prices are still going up. They're not really going down anywhere. They're just not going up by as much. That's something to keep in mind if you're thinking of selling soon. That's also something to keep in mind if you're thinking of buying soon. The effects that this trend are having aren't just, causing changes to home prices. It's also causing mortgage rates to go down. And whatnot. So it's something to keep in mind. I don't think we're in a bubble. I should also state that we're not really in a housing bubble. The factors that are at play here are not, being artificially driven by, the stuff that we saw before the housing crisis, but it's something to keep in mind.
So Jacob, if you're sitting on a house and you've been thinking about selling, do you think that
this trend that you're seeing means that you might want to get out now and sell while it's still seller's market?
Yeah. So I think it depends on the market itself. The common refrain is that real estate is local. Mm-hmm. So you should look first if homes in your area have been selling, how quickly they've been selling, and what price they've been selling. You know, it's one thing to say home values aren't growing as much as they were a year ago in Seattle, but in a specific neighborhood in Seattle, that might be very different.
Right.
And so that's one thing to keep in mind. There was another study I had written about, a few months back, about how some economists were predicting that the next recession may occur in 2020. So that's not too far away. So if you're, if you're deciding whether or not you want to sell, you definitely want to sell at the peak of the market, not at the low point of the market. So that might be a reason to sell now. But there are other factors you should keep in mind besides the home's price. You know, keep in mind mortgage rates. You know, if you're going to sell your home and you're going to have to take out a new mortgage, the rates are higher now than mm-hmm. they have been in years. And so that might add to your housing-related costs. And also, you know, the main reason a lot of people aren't selling is because they don't have anywhere to go. You know, if other homes mm-hmm. aren't on the market to buy, you're in a tough spot if this is your home rather than like a second home or something like that.
Yeah.
So definitely before you put your home on the market, make sure you have an exit strategy in mind.
Well, very good advice.
always good points from the dynamic duo of Ali Melito and Jacob Passy. And this week we have a trifecta with Angela Moore. I'm surrounded by Market Watch. Guys, Ooh. Thank you. Yep. Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you both have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye, guys. Welcome back, and it's time now, Angela, for our Legal Eagles segment. This is one of our more favorite segments of the show, even though all the children on the show are treated equally, but this one gets a lot of fanfare. And I'm very pleased to tell you that we're joined by our legal eagles, Kevin Walsh and David Levine, both of Groom Law Group. Guys, how are you today?
Good, good. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for coming on. You guys have a good week, David?
Absolutely. It was a very good week. It was Kevin and I spent a lot of time traveling around the United States together.
Well, that's awesome. I can only imagine. I want to see the video. So I think this week we're going to talk about multiple employer plans, or MEPs. Is that correct, David?
It is. We're going to talk about MEPs. I think we've touched on them a little bit in the past, but we think the time, and we've said it before, is coming soon. So we thought it'd be good to talk about where we are right now and what this might mean as we go forward.
Awesome.
Great. So why are we talking about MEPs this week? Simply put, for any of you who follow healthcare, you've seen that in the land of healthcare, there's the so-called association health plan guidance. What does that mean in English? Guidance that allows associations to provide health plans for a bunch of unaffiliated employers in a single health plan arrangement. Sounds a lot like a MEP for retirement plans. Well, we've also talked in the past about RESA and the different forms of proposed legislation. A couple weeks ago, we talked about Senator Cotton's bill and multiple employer plans. And there seems to be a groundswell, you know, let's be realistic. Who knows if it's going to get through Congress this year? But there's a groundswell of support for a lot of folks. And we think that MEPs are going to come in at some point here, whether it gets finished now or finished in the next 6 months, whether the administration gets behind it or not, we'll have to see. You know, the DOL historically has not been a fan, but we have to see what Congress does and see how it goes from there. So for right now, MEPs are getting more attention because people are starting to think, okay, if there's a MEP, what does that mean? And there's a lot of different ways, and I'll talk a little more and then toss to Kevin. But as an example, will this mean a world that there's only a few multiple employer plans, like the superannuation plans in Australia? My personal guess, no. I think it's going to be a world where a lot of multiple employer plans are created by advisors, and other intermediaries, and it's almost going to be a reshuffling of the deck of cards. Instead of having lots of individual plans, you'll have lots of MEPs, and everybody will be saying, choose mine, choose mine. And plan sponsors are going to have to say, what do I choose? And advisors are going to be in an interesting position, and other service providers, because they're going to be both selling their MEP, but some of them are also going to be saying, let me monitor your MEP, the so-called mind the minder. And I'm already seeing people go down that road. So I think right now, one of the things to tee up, and I'll hand to Kevin, is, Kevin, what do you think people should be thinking about right now?
I think in terms of the MEP space, just watching it, as you talked about, the Association Health Plans signal that there is an interest in the Republicans, and it seems bipartisan a little bit in the MEP space, to try to, at least with small employers, kind of allow them to band together to offer benefits. So to me, kind of the path forward, there's really three key considerations. One is, if there's MEP legislation or MEP regulations, who does it apply to? Does the guidance allow for big companies to join MEPs? Does it only allow small companies to join MEPs? Are there any limitations on who can band with who else? Are there limitations on who can sponsor a MEP? And then the other two considerations really are kind of more practical here. And one is, what type of fiduciary protections are there for plan participants? This is one of the areas where MEPs have been coming under fire, which is, you know, will they have the same fiduciary protection as a single employer Title I plan? So will the company have individuals who are fiduciaries looking after the participants' beneficiaries, or will they be off the hook? And then kind of the final aspect of the kind of the MEP movement, the thing to watch is, do they drive down costs? To me, the base argument for MEPs is driving down costs, because kind of scaling up small employers coming together. So I think those are the three areas where, if I was watching this space, I'd really be looking for arguments for and against by looking at those three factors. David?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think your points are excellent, Kevin. The only thing I would add in is, as a plan sponsor, is you're likely going to get hit by on two different sides by people saying pro-MEP, anti-MEP when it comes out. And just like you always look with a careful eye at whatever anybody tries to pitch you and sell you, whether it be a lawyer or anybody else, I think you're going to want to think carefully and say, what's in it for these folks who are pitching me the MEP? Do they have different stakes, different interests that are in line with mine or not? And long term, there's lots of opportunities there, but there's also lots of challenges. Nothing is a free lunch, and I think it's just important to keep that in mind. But I'll leave it there and hand it back to Jeff.
Well, thanks, guys. And you know, it's really interesting. Angela and I were talking to another Angela Antonelli, earlier today from the Georgetown Center for Retirement Initiatives, and she was talking about access. And one of the things that they were talking about at Georgetown was how states and municipalities can work together to offer access to retirement programs. And when you started talking about MEPs, you know, instead of just creating their own thing, so, you know, Illinois, Oregon, Maryland, and California, and among others, have created their own plan. And are there opportunities like what's going on in 529 plans with the ABLE accounts to kind of create a coalition, if you will, where you can have scale? And it sounds like a MEP is very similar. I know there are legal differences, but I'm wondering if there's a possibility that if someone rolls out a MEP, if they could partner with another organization in order to create scale. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think this is the thing. MEPs are about different types of scale. I also think that you've raised a comment. I think there's lots of different political views on this, but there are some who feel that the state should not be in the middle of this discussion. There's some who do. I think they frame it as it should be a private market, a public market solution. And the entire idea of MEPs underneath it all very much is designed to create efficiency, mm-hmm. and bring it together. I think that there's a lot of different stakeholders, though, and I think they're all pushing in different directions. So in my mind, I don't see this as a 529 analogy. I see it more sort of as I said, a reshuffling of the deck of cards or a reslicing of the pie as to where the dollars go. Because, yes, there's some who definitely think, well, why don't we just have state-run programs? I'm sure we can all guess that there's different political views on that.
Yeah. And I wasn't trying to espouse a particular point of view. I just was raising it as, you know, they sound very similar to the layperson if you're not aware of the legal structures. But at the end of the day, trying to find that solution – there may be some compromises and people trying to work in between, I guess, is what I was saying. So there's lots of different solutions out there.
I wholeheartedly concur with you, and I didn't think you were pushing one over the other. You're right. I think if you look at folks, there's just a lot of different viewpoints. And that's why I think we're going to have a marketplace of MEPs where people have their different viewpoints. And it'll take a good period of time to see which one becomes the more dominant structure.
So, guys, with all these mini MEPs out there, is that good for consumers? Is that competition going to help us?
I would argue yes, because I my personal view of the world here is that if you get down to just a very, very narrow list of solutions, innovation declines. I think that the needs really vary. Take, for example, nonprofits versus for-profits. There are some nonprofits that are very high touch with their employees and are very and really want that. So maybe they're going to want a very high touch MEP. And there are others that are just going to be like bargain basement. As the court cases are showing us these days, the court cases that are really going to trial, the defendants are winning a good number, and they've really come to the point that it's cheapest is not always required. It's what are you getting for what you buy, and what's right. Your process. So to me, I think that the diversity of choice is good, because to be realistic, there will be really good solutions, but I'm sure, as we all know, there will be solutions that are not as positive.
Well, that was a great question, and I guess more to come. And I guess the most important thing to take away is that these are conversations that are happening. People realize that people need access, and there are a lot of different ways to get there, but at least we're having the conversation. Guys, always a pleasure to talk to you. The Legal Eagles, you guys are great. And that's not an endorsement. It's a fact. You guys are great. I can't give endorsements, but you're wonderful, and appreciate you coming on the show. And for you, Angela Moore, hopefully this was a palatable experience for you.
It was a delight.
We appreciated having you on the show. We always appreciate diversifying the guests, having differences of opinion, having different perspectives, and hopefully you'll be willing to come back. We didn't scare you off.
You did not scare me. I don't scare easy.
Okay, well, great. So, Angela, the Legal Eagles, thank you all very much. And to our audience, have a wonderful weekend, and we'll catch you again next week on the Weekly Pulse Sunday. Bye, guys.
All right, thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye-bye.